in your fields of other. Come and be real for us, are you with your mind? Oh yes, you are beautifully fine, oh girl.
Welcome to the 9th JoeCast. This is a Christmas conversation with Chris Knowles. I'm making a free JoeCast for the occasion. Doesn't mean I don't want need you to subscribe, so please do if you want to support the children of Job and this enterprise into 2024. Thanks to those who have subscribed or come through the paywall. Your support is always greatly appreciated.
Boy, just like a boat you are sunk, but somehow you float, you do men.
Hello?
Yes. Hello.
Oh, yes, you are so much you speak.
Thank you for the book, by the way.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm reading it in my very ADD sort of oblique fashion, where I never read a nonfiction book start to finish. I always just like tear in like different parts until I've read the whole thing, and then I read it over. It's it's a very oblique and indirect way of reading, but I noticed you were talking a lot about Steiner, and I was very interested about that as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it seems like a good way to read that book, and probably many of my books, they're not really that linear.
I like that, non-linear. Yes, my consumption of reading material is very non-linear. I think it's probably a function of being on the internet for 30 years.
Could be. Well, I guess let's get rolling then.
All right.
I'm not sure how cognizant you are of my current focus, but this is the the podcast that I've started now since The Liminalist, having, I thought, retired from podcasting entirely, but aware that you never really know when it's over. I've ended up starting this thing, which I'm calling the JobCast, which is connected to the Substack, The Children of Job, and I'm focusing on the book of Job, and then by extension the Bible, and by extension scripture and people's idea about God. But it's just a departure point. We always need a departure point. Like Charles Fort says, one measures a circle beginning anywhere. Well, I decided this time to begin with God because, well, that's the most likely place to end up. But we don't have to be confined to that. That's a starting point.
Well, I'll tell you what, you call the shots and I'll do the best I can.
Sure. Okay. So without further preamble then, I'll just find out where you stand on this, and then we can see if it's going to be how far we can go on this particular topic, because I mean we've got so many different things that we can talk about for sure, because our work overlaps in so many different ways, but not necessarily this way. So what's your take on the Bible in a few words or a few lines? Like, is it something that you've given much attention?
I don't know if I can give you my elevator pitch on the Bible. It's a big complex work. 66 books, written at all different time periods. I prefer the King James, by the way. I prefer the language of the King James. I find that the modern translations are incredibly uninspired, particularly the American Standard Version, which we used to, when I was in church, when we were doing our communion, I mean, I'm sorry, our confirmation classes, they gave us these Good News Bibles, which was this really vapid and uninspired translation. The King James is the close, I mean, of course, there's the Vulgate, right? But the King James, to me, is the closest we have to having that kind of linguistic and literary authority.
So you were raised in this climate then? You're talking about confirmation. This was during your childhood or teenage years?
Intensely. Yeah, very intense religious upbringing.
Okay, well, that's really what I was asking more, as much as anything. Like, I don't expect you to have a scholarly take on something that you haven't, you know, you're not dedicating an analysis of, but I was just getting a sense of your background, because I wasn't, you know, I was raised in a totally atheistic background. I only came to the Bible in my 20s. I mean, my first encounter with the Bible, as I've already said on this podcast, was defacing a Gideon's Bible in a hotel room.
my mother and my stepfather are both, they are regional directors of the Gideon Society, so...
So don't tell them then.
I won't tell them, I promise. Yeah.
Right. So how was it then? I mean, obviously it's a huge subject. I don't expect you to go into your whole childhood, but you know, how was it and how much did it stick, that upbringing?
Well, it's funny because my upbringing was completely schizophrenic, because at the same time there was, you know, this very powerful presence of the church. There was just, first of all, there's this utter and complete chaos at home, and a lot of, let's just say, mixed signals from my parents as far as their own personal behaviors. Let's just put it at that, rather charitably. So it was chaotic and schizophrenic, but I really see, well, first of all, like, the church has been, you know, historically a very central part of my family and still is, my extended family. Like I said, my mother and my stepfather are, you know, they're Gideons, and they're also Baptists. I'm not exactly sure what denomination it is, but you know, they're really hardcore about it. Mm. And to be honest with you, knowing their pasts as I do, I find it a bit, I don't want to say offensive, but a bit cheeky, let's just say, you know, when they get rolling on it, because it's certainly their behaviors, in, you know, particularly in my formative years, didn't really bear out there.
Sure, right.
You know what I mean?
My background, I mean, in a secular way, that I was raised in this socialist climate where they were advocating all these progressive socialist values. Well, to some extent they were practicing, because they were sexual libertines, but in terms of being genuinely caring about the common man and that kind of thing, there was none of that going on. So I saw through that whole thing very early on. So it's maybe a slight
background of that. Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, in the Victorian era, the English were extraordinarily fanatical, I guess you could argue. I mean, I remember reading that there would, you know, be riots in the streets over just one particular pastor advocating one particular interpretation of scripture. You know, it was very fraught. And I think that the Great War, as they called it, I think that shattered that consensus, but, you know, particularly in England, you know, Verdun and Gallipoli and all these kind of killing fields. I think that socialism became, and not socialism, you know, as it's understood, this kind of bourgeois, bohemian type of interpretation of socialism, which is really just a LARP and a pose, but that became a substitute or surrogate Christianity for the English upper middle classes.
Yeah, that's another parallel then, isn't it? So, but I mean, in my case, I pretty much did throw out the baby with the bathwater. Like, I saw through the hypocrisy of that kind of progressive, enlightened, atheistic, supposedly socialistic worldview, and just saw that it was, you know, there wasn't much substance to it. And so actually I kind of went in the opposite direction, and I don't feel that I lost a great deal. Like, I did end up running a thrift store on something that might be considered socialist principles, but I didn't have to read any Marx or Engels to do it. It was just common human decency. But anyway, the point I'm getting to is I don't, where I'm at now in my 50s, I don't see much of value to go back to and try and retrieve from that socialist ideology, whereas I'm wondering how you feel about your religious thing. I presume you rejected it, but
I don't see it that way at all.
Oh, you don't? Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to presume. So just tell me.
I think that what I rejected was the I think the stasis and the boredom of it. I think that any institution becomes more obsessed with its self-maintenance and its survival than its original principles.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to be one of these. I find all this Christian bashing to be just so specious and tiresome. I don't fault. I mean, there are still an overwhelming majority of good people involved in churches and they do good work. And I don't think that our culture and our civilization can survive without these people, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I think the problem is, and I think the thing that is more of a turnoff to people than what they claim to be, which is in a lot of cases just drama queenism, right? But I think it's just the boredom. First of all, churches are, you know, for all this nonsense about patriarchy, anybody who's belonged to a church just laughs when they hear that, because even the most conservative churches are essentially matriarchal. Mm. The women run it. The women run the churches, which I think tends to alienate men in some ways. You know, the women's clubs are much more active and involved in 99% of the churches in this country, at least, than the men's clubs are. And it just becomes kind of a clubhouse.
Yeah.
You know, a matriarchal clubhouse. And I think that's the real, in all this nonsense you hear about patriarchy and this and that, it's all just complete and utter tripe. Just completely throw it in the trash. It has no basis in reality whatsoever. And anybody who's belonged to any kind of serious denomination or church organization or institution will tell you that. It's just all this, it's just so feeble and ridiculous.
Let's stay on that then, since it's such a big subject. The word patriarchal obviously refers to patriarchs, and the patriarchs historically are the early Israelites. Those are the original patriarchs. So there is that correlational conflation between these ideas of patriarchy and religion, which is what you're zeroing in on, I think. But probably for your average woke person who's ranting about the patriarchy, they do hate Christianity, they do hate religion, generally speaking, and they also hate the idea that white men rule the world. Or maybe I shouldn't say they, but in this ideological mindset, there is this conflation of these two things.
Total science fiction, by the way.
Yeah, well, they're clearly not, is all I was going to say. Even the idea that men run the world is obviously Big Mother is trying to get to the heart of that question, that myth, really. But at least superficially, one could say, yeah, okay, historically, men have been in more positions of power than women, but that doesn't correlate with patriarchs per se or religious leaders. I mean, is that the point that you're zeroing in on there around the view of church members?
Well, so just like say the Vatican, obviously. Men, right? It's all the cardinals and archbishops and so on, and the Pope, right? I mean, that's all male, but that's the organization. That's the organizational part. That's the infrastructure. When you get down to the local level, any Catholic church is going to be run by women,
right?
Anywhere, particularly nowadays. I think that. Again, so, you know, you talk about woke. Woke is, and I said this before, it was hip to say this, by the way, that woke is just Calvinism without the grace. You know, it's the same idea of, you know, predestination and total depravity and all these Calvinistic ideas, just without the grace and without forgiveness, right? It's a sick and demented pseudo-religion that leads to destruction and misery. I mean, just pure and simple. And the chickens are already coming home to roost. We're already seeing the woke industrial complex starting to turn in on itself and start to devour itself. And it's a wonderful thing to see, because it's a completely satanic system, right? It's completely evil. It's completely irredeemable. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful thing to see it destroy itself. And I think that it will offer great entertainment value to watch evil consume evil, right?
But, I guess, I don't want to interrupt. Actually, go carry on. We can come back to that.
So, but no, the point is that in the same way that this kind of LARP socialism became a replacement Anglicanism for the English upper middle classes, we saw woke became the same thing for upper middle class white women, who are the vast, overwhelming consumers and adherents to wokeness. It's almost completely. And, you know, this sort of non-white purse puppy types, you know, that they use as shields. So, again, I don't think, I'll just give you a very simple example. I was reading about this church group, this men's group in somewhere in the South, might have been Mississippi. But what they do is that they look after, you know, like older women, you know, retirees, people on fixed incomes and stuff, particularly when there are storms and such, or there's a harsh winter storm or something. You know, these men take it upon themselves to care for people who fall between the cracks, right? And this is something that we used to take for granted. I mean, there used to be these groups. This was the backbone of every community in this country's history. And that's fading away. And the government is not going to replace that. It simply can't. You know, no matter how you feel about the beneficence or the maleficence of the government, it simply doesn't have the resources to fill the role that, like, these men groups, these Christian men groups that, you know, particularly just out of a sense of Christian charity would spend a lot of time helping people, a lot of time in their own resources. Can we survive without that? Can this culture and the society and the civilization survive without that? I don't think so. So unless there's some kind of turnaround, and I'm not necessarily advocating a return to, like, you know, Reformation baptism or whatever, but there's got to be some sort of glue that binds our society together, or there's just nothing. There's just absolutely nothing. And anyone who thinks that, you know, welfare programs and all the rest of it can fill that void are completely deluding themselves.
So I'm wondering, because earlier you mentioned, you described the woke thing as a satanic system. And in fact, what I was going to interrupt you with was when you were saying that it could be entertaining to see it falling apart. I was going to say, how can you be sure you're going to be on the outside of that?
I can't. None of us can.
Because then it wouldn't be entertaining, right? If we're on the inside and this system is eating itself, we're actually fodder for that satanic mill. And so this intersects with what I was about to ask about what you just said as well, which is, like, at what point, how do you actually draw a line between the visibly satanic ideologies and agendas that have become much more visible in the last few years with you know what? How do you distinguish them from previous agendas and systems and institutions which do include Christian ones as well? Because Christianity has hardly been innocent, right, of satanic oppressions and all the rest of it, even if it's been oversimplified by this counter movement of wokeism, at what point and how far would you go back? Like, what are you trying to preserve or restore is my question.
Well, here's the thing. In my advanced age, I understand that, you know, it's not my job to write these prescriptions for society. It's above my, it's outside my purview and it's above my pay grade. And, yeah, I mean, I would like to see something that would restore a sense of community, particularly in a, you know, increasingly fractured populace. Like I said, it used to be the church. I mean, the church was the central focus of that. But, you know, the church as we understood it, you know, that I understood, that I took for granted back in the 70s, the social conditions for that simply just don't exist anymore. I mean, one of the things that I keep saying and I keep thinking about traditionalism, I mean, traditionalism is wonderful, right? I mean, it's a good dream. But the thing is that the same social condition, social, economic, demographic, technological conditions that created these traditions and created this traditional infrastructure, they just don't exist anymore. It's all gone. You can't rebuild something in soil that has completely become barren, to put it very crudely and clumsily. But I just don't see how we can function without that sense of, you know, common ground and community and, you know, a shared purpose. people talk about things like, you know, technology is not going to do it. Government is not going to do it. We're already seeing, if you take the long view, we're already seeing just a complete ongoing collapse of, you know, let's just call it the beast system, right? If you want to call it the Antichrist system, or what did Steiner call it? He would call it the Ahriman system, right?
Yeah.
The thing about that whole, it can't run things. It's entirely oppositional. Okay, so whether you're talking, however you want to term it, you know, Antichrist, Ahriman, whatever terminology, the Matrix, you know, whatever sort of terminology you want to use to describe the system that was once in opposition and now has become the establishment, the reason why it can't sustain itself because it lacks the fundamental understanding of what it was, is that it was an oppositional system, you know what I mean? And you can't have an oppositional system run, you know, the mainstream. It's just not going to work, and it's already falling apart rather rapidly. And I think that one thing that we should all be concerned about is that, like a cornered beast, it's going to do nothing but lash out viciously, increasingly violently. And I think you could argue that we're already seeing that now. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, I can just sort of look at things and sort of evaluate things. I don't know if I can necessarily solve them because I simply don't have the power to do so.
Well, no. I mean, none of us do, really. I mean, even Elon Musk and these guys, obviously we're not going to really look to save us if we're thinking right. But even all the worldly power in the world, in the hands of a human being or even a group of human beings, even if they were benign, which is impossible to imagine for me, is not going to do it. And I think, and that's my view anyway, and I think I'd go even further myself than you and say that I can't even understand the nature of the problem, which is precisely why I would never even dream of trying to solve it. I mean, when I said about the thrift store, that was an example of how I discovered what works running a thrift store. And I was struck by, well, some of the ways that we choose to run this, because it's good business sense, but it's also just good human compassion response to other humans, they did coincide with certain principles and certain ideologies, which I have very little interest in, because I've got no interest in ideologies except to destroy them, you know, to expose them as false and hypocritical. I'm just going to close that door. But they do exist as principles. It's just when they're assembled into an ideology and then they're applied. I think you inferred this right near the beginning, that any kind of system or institution eventually becomes the opposite of what it's supposedly set up to do. It just seems to be built into the nature of institutions and groupings. So yeah, I can see that there's an instinctive, intuitive way of being in the world that allows for community to flourish and thrive and for human beings to thrive within it, but that it can't be, it seems to me, it can't actually be applied top down, first of all, at all. But then this is also leads to my next point, which it seems as though that for it to be organic, so that it's coming through the separate members of the community in this just natural way that doesn't require ideologies and systems and oppressive rules of thought, it has to be a small enough community. So as soon as we get a larger and larger, and eventually this global village that McLuhan predicted, and it was McLuhan also who talked about Satan being an electrical engineer, and of course the global village depends on electricity and electronics. But as soon as we get this, the larger it gets, the more necessary the top-down control becomes, and the more tyrannical it becomes. And I think we as individuals who are trying to find our way through and out of that satanic system get tricked and trapped by this idea that we have to somehow think about the problems of billions of people, but it's absolutely impossible to think about, never mind understand, never mind come up with a solution. So
that's what the system does, is that it one thing that I think about a lot as well is that how, you know, there's this whole idea, let's just call it, that every citizen is somehow responsible, you know, that we still live like in a village in colonial times where every citizen is participatory and every citizen has a stake, right? We live in a situation now where most of us are completely alienated and disenfranchised from any sense of power. So why should we have to espouse some sort of philosophy of, you know, redemption for people who, first of all, don't care about us, and secondly, we have absolutely no effect or influence on whatsoever. Right. You know, this is like the American civic religion. So before we had woke, in the post-war era, we had like the rise of a kind of American civic religion. And it's like, you're all citizens, you know, you all have the franchise of the vote, you're all responsible, you know, you all should have an idea, you should all, you know, have this, you know, this complete fantasy that you somehow are part of a democratic system. Yeah. And, you know, particularly after the war, with the rise of the military-industrial complex, that whole notion just became complete fantasy. But I think part of the control matrix was to get people just sort of wrapped around these ideas where, like, you had to come, you know, if you complained about something, you had to come up with a solution for it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like that was, you know, that was your area of expertise somehow, you know what I mean? And it's just complete fantasy. So, you know, nothing is going to stop the train that we're on now. The, you know, the control matrix is in complete control. And they're also insane and incompetent. And they're going to crash the train sooner than later. And I think the responsibility then is how do we rebuild it? And this is not unlike, you know, what we saw in ancient Rome. I mean, so the Catholic Church or the Roman Church, people don't really understand the social conditions in which that arose in which, you know, Constantine he permitted Christianity to be practiced legally. It wasn't until Theodosius, 50 years later, where it became, the cult of state. But it really was because you had this, this teeming empire filled with all these different people, with all these different religions and all these different traditions and all these different customs and all these different cultures. And you cannot sustain a coherent nation or empire without something to bind them all together. So so a lot of Protestants, particularly like reformist Protestants and stuff, will complain about all the, the indulgence of all the, the paganism that the church allowed and stuff. But I think they failed to grasp the wisdom of that it was a tolerance and it was an indulgence. It wasn't an endorsement or an acceptance. People like Pope Leo and so on. So I think that, I think ultimately something like that will arise again. Okay. I think, woke is obviously going to self-destruct. But also at the same time, I wouldn't be surprised, right, if what replaces the current system that we have now, the insane matrix B system, is some sort of synthesis of Christianity and socialism. And I don't mean like the socialism that you grew up with. I mean like, working class labor socialism. I think that would probably be the compromise that would, probably be extraordinarily authoritarian, at least for some time. But I think that the complete chaos and breakdown and destruction would necessitate that. I mean, I'm not saying that's something I want to see, but I also don't want to see the people currently running the system now continue to run the system. But again, it's like it's completely above my power to influence that.
Well, and even to really know when and where and how the train is going to crash, so much speculation is involved in this. Is your forecast of the train crash and the system, the beast system collapsing, what's your basis for it? Like, what do you see besides, I understand what you see about these ideologies that are devouring themselves, but isn't woke just the latest iteration, and that we've seen many iterations before and there are perhaps many more to come? And as long as there's the technology and the fuel sources to maintain the the progress of the hegemony of the Ahrimanic system and the entities and whatnot, what's going to stop it? Or is your prognosis based on the idea that oil is going to run out, or some sort of financial collapse, or what do you foresee?
I my analysis is based on the fact that it's already begun. Okay. The system as we know it peaked, I would say, around the middle of the Obama era. Okay. And that's when we saw the Maidan thing in Ukraine. What I think kind of the failure of the COVID program that I do think failed. I do think that let's just get past the whole bioengineering aspect of it. Just, the draconian crackdowns and attempts to create this medically based surveillance system. I think that more or less failed. And I think the loss, the absolute crushing loss that NATO has experienced in the Ukraine is also another signpost. I think that the situation going on in Israel now, and how it is completely, completely alienating what they call the Global South, has a lot to do with that. And people will look at the Global South and say, well, these countries' GDPs don't equal, the United States combined or whatever. But that's not the point. The point is that they control or they produce all the natural resources that the world economy needs to run on. And all you need is just a few scattered militias here and there to, do tremendous damage to the system. And we're seeing this now where these Houthi militants in Yemen are starting to try, and in one case they succeed, to hijack Israeli-owned merchant vessels. That's putting a tremendous strain on the United States Navy. It's going to be the death of a thousand cuts, but it has already started. It has already started. Trump, I think, failed. Brexit failed. Bolsonaro failed. All these populist movements failed, but they failed in constructing their own system. But what they did is that they really put the brakes on the momentum, of the beast system. And I'm not endorsing any of those figures or those movements at all, but I'm saying they were useful in one way because they just broke the momentum. And once that momentum is broken, it's very hard to build up again. And I think the collapse of Hollywood, which is really the propaganda wing of the imperial beast system, just completely in free fall right now. No matter whatever kind of conspiracy nonsense, oh, they're just playing fourth dimensional chess or whatever. No, they are in, the whole Hollywood system is just in very, very serious trouble right now. And also people are openly starting to resist all the programming and brainwashing that comes out of that system. And it's becoming very fashionable to do so. It's like I said, it's the death of a thousand cuts, but the collapse process of the beast system has already begun. I have absolutely no doubt about that. I think that the real tyranny and terror that we'll see in the future will be that, that beast lashing out, that, the last gasps of that system. And I what the read in the Bible is in the book of Revelation is the tribulations. I don't think that period will last all that much longer because it's just the system has exhausted itself. It's consumed itself. And that's why, we're hearing that like all these countries just don't have these munitions to send to Ukraine or to Israel or to wherever these sort of proxy wars are being fought.
So how literally do you take the imagery, the analogy of Revelation, the beast system? Like what do you see behind the system that you're seeing that is coming to an inevitable end? Do you see it just human pathologies behind it, or do you have a sense of something literally demonic?
Well, the demonic is the oppositional force, the diablos, the cutting apart, right? So if you look at the entomology, you start to understand what these things mean. Unfortunately, like I said, we have this understanding of Christianity that has been adulterated for centuries. Yeah. And really, in the early 20th century, when it just became this sort of grandmotherly Hallmark card simulacrum, it just drained, where the angels all became like little babies and stuff, all this kind of nonsense, right? I don't know if you've seen the work, but my understanding of Revelation is I started breaking down, like these figures like the Scarlet Woman and the Beast from the Sea and the Locust and so on, and realized that they were all based on star maps. Now, star maps would be how the ancients would understand time. So I think my understanding, at least my interpretation of Revelation, is that certain things are going to happen and that these figures that people have been puzzling over for so long are really just these sort of constellations telling you when And I think the problem is that we've sort of lost that understanding that the ancients had, how they understood, you know, that's all they had. They didn't have atomic clocks, you know, they didn't have all these kind of things. They told time through the stars. I mean, and that's in the first chapter of Genesis, right? So I think that it gets very tricky, right, to take something that is so blatantly and, you know, it tells you right up front that this is all symbolism. And it's the same thing in the book of Daniel and some of these other prophetic books is, you know, in the parables themselves. I mean, you know, the fundamentalism, I understand the impetus behind fundamentalism. It was a reaction to this kind of elitist liberalism that took over the seminaries in the early part of the 20th century. But unfortunately, it threw out the baby with the bathwater, right? The ability to understand symbolism and metaphor and allegory is absolutely crucial in any sort of biblical exegesis, right? It's, you can't do without it. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this whole very, I would argue, very American, right? Very American impulse to just have this one-to-one correspondence, this literalist, fundamentalist view is not only, I think, completely counterproductive, but I think it's actually anti-biblical. You know, I think it goes against what the Bible itself is telling you. Mm. So, you know, I mean, there you go. So I've always been fascinated by the book of Revelation. I've not made any bones about that. And particularly the King James, you know, I just love the language. But I think John of Patmos was like the first great synchromystic, and quite literally so, because like I said, I think that all these figures, these chimeric monstrous figures that people have puzzled over all these years, are actually markers of time. I'll give you an example. Revelation 9, right? People have always talked about the locusts. You know, I remember when I was a kid, like these preachers would tell us it was the Beatles and so on. But if you see it, so it, you know, it's the crown and the man and the hare and the lion. I mean, that's Corona Borealis Boötes, who's a shepherd but also a farmer. The hare is Coma Berenices. And then obviously lion's Leo, and the cup, you know, all these kind of things. What it's taking you, you know, down to the Centaurus, which is the horseman, and the tails of scorpions. It's pretty basic there that's Scorpius. And then the king of the pit, the king of the underworld, is Corona Australis. So it's just taking you in this line. And I think what he's predicting, what I think John is predicting, is I think he was predicting a plague, okay? Because there's a whole understanding of Apollyon and Abaddon, right? Now, Apollyon was the aspect of Apollo that punished sinners by bringing plagues. That was very commonly known in the ancient world. We've lost that understanding. And then, you know, it all becomes mystified. But I think what John of Patmos is telling you is that at this certain point in time, when these constellations are in the sky, there's going to be these terrible plagues that are going to devastate the population, right? And that's why it ends up with Abaddon, with the crown of the south and so on. And also, but also the scorpion's tail was very commonly associated with poison and disease, obviously, right? So anyhow, I mean, you kind of need to walk you through this visually, but if you look at the visuals, and then just read the descriptions that John is putting out, it's just so incredibly obvious to me that he's saying this is going to happen at this time.
But how do you know which time he's referring to?
Well, that's the mystery of it. You know, that's the problem, right? That's the problem, is that we've lost skills that Jews, Christians, pagans, Greeks, everyone in the ancient world understood, that the stars were the way they marked time. So that's what I'm saying, is that John was telling us what is going to happen in the case of Revelation 9, these plagues, right? The locusts, right? And telling you when it's going to happen. But we no longer have the tools to understand how they understood the passage of time.
So how does this, because the question I asked was to do with demons, so how does it connect to that question?
Connect to which question?
The question of how literally you take the idea of demons, of demonic or satanic forces, metaphysical forces are behind what's going on in the world.
Oh, very literally, yeah. I mean, maybe not literally in the sense of, you know, somebody at a fundamentalist church would take it literally. Because I see these things as just spiritual energies,
yeah.
or clusters of power, clusters of energies, however you choose to, that are always around us, you know. And it's almost, it's getting back to the whole disease metaphor, it's almost like a virus, you know. And I think that the body politic is infected by these viruses, let's just call them, you know, at certain points in the timeline. And I think we're just at that timeline now. And that there's a whole host of conditions that have weakened our spiritual immune system.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can talk about how, like, I mean, I remember back about 30 years ago, I had this like really powerful sort of synchronistic epiphany about this local church, right? But the thing is that it was the message and the sign that was the power, because the actual church service, and I went back a few times to sort of, you know, to cement this notion, but it was so boring and it was just so vapid and dead. I mean, that's the problem, I think, with a lot of churches today, is that they're just spiritually dead. And I think they're spiritually dead because they've just been married to the form and not the content. If you understand what I'm saying. And I said, I think that a lot of the alienation that people feel towards the church has less to do with all the sort of, you know, hyperbole and nonsense that we see in the media, and just more to do the fact that it just doesn't do its job. You know, it doesn't relieve us from the misery and the boredom of everyday living. That's what it's supposed to do, and it doesn't do it. I mean, maybe there are churches here and there that do that, but most of them just don't, because they don't even understand that that's their job anymore. They think their job is to, you know, pay the salaries and keep the lights on and maybe have a bake sale now and then.
Well, I mean, there's the confusion that's very far gone now between cultural Christianity and real Christianity, and correspondingly between, and this is where the sort of overlap between Christian ideologies and socialist ideologies happens, perhaps, is, you know, Christ, his kingdom is not of this world. So a true Christian orientation isn't, it's through this world, but it's in this world, but it's not of this world. Where a Christian isn't supposed to value the things of men and the things of the world, and is not meant to put the health of the body or the functioning of society over the soul. And so that's kind of what I've been thinking throughout this conversation. We've been talking about geopolitics and what's going on at a worldly level, and the beast system, and my sense, and how it's failing. But my sense is the beast system is that it's a metaphysical system that, as you were just inferring there, is kind of in the DNA of society. Like it precedes society. Society has grown out of this metaphysical evil, let's say. This is my point of view. And the purpose of these material systems is a satanic one in the true sense, as it's meant to lure people over to the other side, like, you know, Darth Vader with Luke, to get them to comply and consent to regimes and to powers and principalities that they have to be tricked into consenting to. And once it's done that, its work is done and it can collapse. But then what happens when it collapses is as you're inferring in a different way, perhaps, is it takes most of those souls with it because they've aligned with it. That's my sense around all of this. And that, since we were talking about Revelation, I was reminded of Steiner's view on Revelation, or one that really stood out for me that I talked about in a podcast a while back, which is that he talked about the book of Revelation as describing a process that was occurring within the communal body of humanity, let's say, I'm having to paraphrase, and that, for example, the seven vials being opened, that corresponded with actual elements within that communal body. So he was thinking about the processes and the forces that are unleashed during the period of Revelation or the Apocalypse as corresponding to functions within a metaphysical body, like digestion or bile or whatever else. I can't remember how specific he got, but this is something that we're literally within, and that's happening at this hidden level, and it's happening inside us and it's happening outside of us, but it's happening on a worldly stage. That's really kind of the least of it, what's going on at a worldly level. So I'm not, I don't know how confident you are when you're saying that this system failed, but because you've acknowledged that.
No, I said it is failing.
It's failing.
It hasn't completely collapsed yet, but the collapse has begun.
Yeah, and you're acknowledging that the collapse is going, in certain sense, is going to look and feel worse than anything, in a certain sense. Like it's, because I agree that there's something baked into the rule of Antichrist, just to keep it simple, that is built to fail. It's almost as though Satan knows that he's going to fail, and he's just trying to trick as many souls as he can while he's got the time to presume the semblance of power, and that the system is like that as well. It's trying to lure people into believing that it can save them, even though the evidence is more and more obvious that it can't, that it's actually destroying itself. But I don't have the same experience, I guess, as you've had over COVID, because to me, although maybe it seemed to fail socio-politically temporarily, at least, I'm not saying there may be an act too, to me it seemed to succeed horrifically well in terms of how many people actually went along with it, how hard it is to find somebody who actually really questioned
it. That's just human nature, and that most people go along to get along, right? But yeah. You know, it's like COVID is corona, right? So I was talking about Revelation 9. It starts at the crown and ends at the crown. What is the crown? The corona. Yeah. You know, quite literally, right? Yeah. But you got to get back to see my understanding. So when I talk about allegory and symbolism and stuff, that's not like in the kind of wishy-washy liberal Protestant, oh, just do whatever, think whatever, you know, just where it just becomes Unitarianism and all of a sudden you find yourself, you know, practicing witchcraft in church, you know, like what the Unitarians openly do. Yeah. To me, like when you talk about Satan, so Satan in the Bible is, the Old Testament is like basically God's, attorney general, right? Prosecuting attorney. But Satan is clearly part of the, Heavenly Council, what's the Divine Council, right?
Yeah. Is it about the Book of Job now, in fact?
Yeah, well, exactly. But the Christian understanding, because Israel or Judea or the Levant, you know, was occupied by this absolutely intractable force of the Roman Empire, I see that Satan, In the New Testament understanding, is you know, temporal power. It's the worldly powers. Satan is the embodiment of worldly power. So what, and I would argue this, what does Satan tempt Christ with in the wilderness? Mm. Money, power, and, you know, how do we even put, you know, don't tempt God, you know.
Yeah.
So how would you boil that down to a single phrase? Hubris, I guess would be the best adjective for that. So, you know, man does not live by bread alone, you know, the nations of the earth. I think what that is, and if I had sort of a more fundamentalist, say reformist attitude towards this, I would say that, you know, certainly the Roman Church succumbed to these temptations, didn't it? Right. But I don't think it's unique. I think that when a church becomes an institution, it does become, or any religious body, it does become tempted and vulnerable to temptation, to money, power, and authority, like hubris, hubristic authority. So this is what I'm saying, is that once you get past all the dogma and all sort of the add-ons, the things that have sort of been added on over the years, and sort of get back to an understanding, you know, reading the Gospels and reading the early church fathers and stuff, you understand that their ways of understanding are not as arcane and as, you know, disembodied as we tend to think they are. I mean, these were people who were living in the Roman Empire, which really is not very much different than our own. You know, and it, you know, it's certainly, you know, when you talk about somebody like Tiberius, and Tiberius was a moral degenerate that would even shame Joe Biden. Right? You know what I'm saying? So this is what I'm saying. It's like you can't remove these things from the context in which they were written. And once you start to place these things back in the context in which they were written, you really understand that Christianity is a social reform movement above all else. And I think that really has gotten lost. And they were, I don't want to say socialistic because that term is so loaded, but there was that sense of communalism, that sense of community, that, you know, shared suffering and shared bounty, you know, that I think was pretty radical in the context, certainly of the Roman Empire, right? Which in many ways was a mercantile empire, wasn't it? So human nature doesn't change. What does change is that we lose track of what things meant, what words meant. And I think that is our problem today. And this is like my brief against Christianity as it's practiced today, is that it is ahistorical in many ways. And it doesn't, but it also shies away from metaphysics and it shies away from mysticism. And I think you can't separate the Gospels, as I understand them, from metaphysics and mysticism. And the reason why metaphysics and mysticism is so shunned upon is that the Romans hated that stuff. You know what I mean? The Romans were extraordinarily pragmatic, practical people who looked askance at anything remotely mystical or metaphysical. You know, that was trouble to them, you know, because like I said, they were like very left brain sort of alpha male types. So now to get back to your question about the system. So what I'm trying to say is that we've been here before. All right. We've been through all this before. We'll probably be through it all again. Mm-hmm. To me, you know, this is why I'm not a Protestant and so on, because there's a whole idea of dispensationalism where everything is linear, moving from Genesis to Revelation. But the other thing I would also argue is that, you know, Revelation has this very dark and ominous sort of reputation, but that's because people don't get to the final chapters. The thing I like to tell people is that, you know, Revelation is the happiest ending ever. You know what I mean? You know, it's like the lions lie down with the lamb and, you know, heaven descends to earth, right? So, I mean, we have a lot of trouble understanding that today, but that's how it was understood back then.
Sure. I was made the same point roughly recently that we've just retained the meaning of the word apocalypse as something terrible, as in actual fact, although the revelation, the first part of the revelation is terrible because it reveals what's been done to our natures, you know, how we've been compromised by this virus, or however we're going to talk about it. The rest of the revelation is good, and you can't get to the good stuff without going through the bad stuff. But we've only really retained the first meaning of the apocalypse is something terrible and horrific and catastrophic, and yet weirdly we're kind of perversely drawn to it, right?
It's human nature.
Well, yeah, so let's come back to this question of human nature, because that's one of the things you said I wanted to zero in on, which is that I don't agree that it's human nature to, let's say, comply with satanic agendas, because that was what I was talking about. Because if it was, well, Satan's work would be easy, right? He just has to let humans follow their nature and be what they naturally are. I think it's actually the inverse is true. It's human nature to be aligned with nature, which is to be aligned with the divine, you know, the metaphysical principles of existence, which are eternal, hence cyclical. So I'd say that human nature, theoretically or ideally, it doesn't change because it's innate. It's like that divine spark in us. And in a certain sense, it can't ever be changed because you can't ever take the God out of the man, I don't think. But I think that the whole transhumanist agenda is exactly about that. Like they, whoever this they is, because it's still, you know, the jury's not out yet, but they, whether it's human and demonic or a mixture of both, whatever that they refers to, have been working very, very hard and diligently, or we could say it, we just say it's a virus, for hundreds of thousands of years perhaps, to divorce human beings from their nature and to create an artificial nature, which is really central to, I think, what we're talking about. I mean, I think in terms of metaphysical powers and principalities of darkness that actually implement their agenda through human beings in a system that is visible through technology and social arrangements and all the rest of it, that seems to be what it comes down to, is actually trying to reconfigure the human form in a way that is a distorted mockery of the human form, and it, by the same token, or in the process, to disconnect human consciousness from the body, from physicality, and thereby from its nature, so human beings actually can be lured, they can be lured to go against their nature in that sense.
Well, two things I would say is that getting back to the beast system and the beast and Revelation 13, where no man could buy or sell without the mark.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think that we certainly saw that in many, many ways in a lot of countries with the COVID thing, where if you didn't take these, you know, these transhumanist gene therapy injections, you know, you couldn't go to your job. You couldn't go to the doctor. I mean, all these kind of restrictions. So I think that plays a big part of it. But I think at the basis of it, when you look at transhumanism and you look at like things like the singularity and you look at like Ray Kurzweil, who seems to be an overwhelmingly influential presence in this, what drives him is just his tremendous fear of death.
Yeah.
Right. And fear of death is fear of nature. Okay. Yeah. Because death is an intrinsic part of nature. I mean, everything lives and dies. You know, one of the reasons why I wouldn't subscribe to any sort of established Christian tradition is that, you know, I, first of all, I believe very strongly in reincarnation, and I believe that everything's cyclical and not linear. I believe that we've had apocalypses before. You know, I would cite the Bronze Age collapse as a pretty, you know, pretty straight up apocalyptic scenario. And also, I mean, one of the things that I argue so much about when people sort of talk about like the Apostle Paul, and he was predicting this whole apocalyptic, you know, this war, this and the oppression of the believers and such, and they said, well, that never came. And it's just like, how stupid are you? Did you pay any attention in history class to what happened in, you know, AD 70 in Jerusalem? That was an apocalypse, you know. I mean, how much more of an apocalypse, you know, where the temple is destroyed and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people are driven out of their country. How is that not an apocalypse? How would you, if you were a believing Jew in the first century AD, how would you not see that as the end of the world? Because your religion is completely inseparable from your politics and inseparable from your worldview. How would you not see that as an apocalypse? Apocalypse did come to that community. There's just absolutely no getting past it. But this is like, you know, this whole dumbed down fundamentalist Hollywood idea of apocalypse, where, you know, it's based in this whole dispensationalist idea, which, again, I completely reject. But apocalypses have happened. You know, I mean, we could maybe even cite, you know, the whatever happened in the 6th and 7th centuries as an apocalypse, whatever, you know, whatever created, you know, wiped out, what, 2/3 of the population of Europe and you know, just civilization was just brought to a screeching halt, at least in Europe. That was apocalyptic. But apocalyptic in the, you know, the general sense, you know, in the semantic sense, it's, you know, as you mentioned before, it's the reality underneath the illusion being revealed. So apocalypse, to my mind, is, you know, it's disclosure, right? You know, it's the unveiling. So it's not, but I think what you see in the book of Revelation, and maybe, you know, maybe it's not describing a single moment in time. Maybe it's describing a process that, you know, that the Jews saw in AD 70, not long after the book was written, that all of Western Europe saw in the 6th century, that the entire known world saw in the Bronze, you know, the Bronze Age collapse. I mean, all these, going back to Sumer, you know, in the 3rd dynasty of Ur, when they had reestablished themselves after, you know, after sort of regaining power after they were displaced by the Akkadians, what soon happened after that is all the events that we're still puzzling over, that, you know, the Lamentations of Ur and stuff, which were directly adapted by the Bible writers for the Book of Lamentations. So this is all cyclical. These things happen over and over again. And I think that if we took that understanding and applied that to a Christian understanding, I don't see anything in the Gospels or in the epistles themselves that contradict that or prohibit that, okay? And this is my problems with Christianity are cosmological, really, and that's only Christianity as it's commonly practiced. You know, I just have a much different cosmology. I have a much different metaphysics that is based essentially in the cycles of nature, which, as you said, are the cycles of the divine.
Yeah, well, I mean, Christianity is, if it's not sourced in the New Testament and even specifically the Gospel, then it's got no roots at all. So if you just refer
exactly
to those words, and as far as we can, obviously we don't have the original, but then yeah, you won't find very much or anything that contradicts. You know, it doesn't exclude a whole bunch of other lenses by which to look at our experience.
It's all about power, though. It's all about power and money. Like, my group controls this group now, or my church. You have to do what I say. And that's, again, that's human nature.
I'm going to say that it's human nature if it's been co-opted or, you know, handled by this satanic impulse. And I think I want to bring it back to the, because Satan, that's his game, really. He can use anything against us, even our best qualities, which is back to Jesus in the desert, really. You know, if we're willing to take the line of least resistance and opt for our own convenience and comfort, then he's got us, right? And to bring it back to something you said about Kurzweil and this fear of death, I mean, this is true of Kurzweil, and it certainly does underscore his limitations as a human being, and also what's driving all of transhumanism. But it's also something that we can all identify with. We can all relate to, like, fear of death. You know, even if you believe in reincarnation, which I do on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, but I don't on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Like, I can't entirely get behind anything that I can think about with my mind, right? But certainly, it seems like it's got credence, and I've got experiences that seem to back it up. But even so, the idea of death, as long as I've got this sense of a personal identity, which I do, and, you know, I'm not enlightened, I'm not Jesus, it is terrifying, the idea of death, if I feel my way into it enough. And to me, we're talking about the apocalypse being cyclical, and therefore there's been many apocalypse is, at least in this profane sense of things coming to a complete and utter and final end, at least until the next cycle, on a large scale, but even more, I would say even more demonstrably, but even more inescapably for each of us as individuals, we all have our personal apocalypses, you know, on the menu, like they're in sight. You're talking about being a certain age. Well, I'm at a certain age too, in my mid-50s, where death is no longer some abstract thing. I'm actually not counting the days, but I'm counting my blessings for every year that I haven't got some hideous diagnosis, right? It's just, it's very palpably real to me. And because of my beliefs, which, whether they include a reincarnation or not, certainly the idea of death includes for me revelation, like that whatever I've tried to avoid in life, I'm going to have to face in death. I very much have that belief. So I can't look forward to it, but I can't avoid it either. And the last thing I wanted to bring into this, because these are all thoughts I've been having while you were talking, was, you know, what is the cure for that? What is the cure for fear of death? And it is religion. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer. But in what sense is it? And also bring it back to this collective apocalypse, this idea we have about a collective apocalypse. There's something about dying that is easier to take if we don't die alone. Like if we can die somehow in collective experience. And so, of course, a collective apocalypse is that idea written large, and you join a community of Christians who believe in the end times. We've seen this with cults, of course, and they feel like somehow death has lost its sting because they're going to die together. Well, that's a dark side if you're going to look at Heaven's Gate or something, and even many Christian sects. But I think there's a light side too, which is that the real purpose of religion, as in doctrines that you adhere to, as opposed to just an internal connection to the divine, which doesn't require religion, in my view, or it just is religion, is that you become more embedded in a communal body, a metaphysical communal body. And that I think, and this is what Steiner, I think he talked about it some of the time, that there is... Yeah, it's only the souls that we've managed to forge a truly soul connection with, the only the people that we've managed to experience a soul connection with in life, that we will be able to find in death, that we will be with in death. And that was Dante's, the way that he described heaven was also souls that are connected and that form a kind of system, like a Christmas tree lights is the analogy that comes to mind. But you know, the soul can't exist outside of the body. Once the body's died, it can't exist except in communion with Christ in the Christian sense and other souls that are also oriented towards that thing. It's difficult stuff to talk about, but I just thought it brought a lot of different things together. So I just wanted to share it as kind of a unified view that I have around these things, you know, religion, community, death, apocalypse. They all seem to be moving parts of the same complex.
Well, let me put it this way, and maybe somebody better versed in the Bible might quibble with this, but when my understanding of the Gospels, right? And it's interestingly that I saw a rather young minister or preacher make the same argument that I was just kind of blown away by, because I thought it was just my weird idiosyncratic interpretation. But he said that, you know, if you really read what Jesus is saying, he's talking about bringing, you know, the kingdom to earth, on earth as it is in heaven. So what it is that there's this notion that Jesus and the apostles, you know, particularly the Apostle Paul, had this like crypto-Egyptian fixation on the afterlife, right? And that is very Egyptian, because the entirety of Egyptian religion, which was obviously well known and powerful and influential at the time in that place, I don't see it that way, though. I see that what Jesus was talking about was bringing the kingdom to earth to live a more abundant life, you know, to live a life in communion with God, right? Not oh, I'm just going to suffer silently, and then I'll get, you know, I'll just punch my ticket at the end and get my reward, and then things will be great. You know, I'm not arguing that that's not also part and parcel of the message, but I think that what Jesus's focus was, and this was my understanding. I remember reading the Gospels in my early 20s, reading the entire New Testament, actually, that it was about bringing divinity to this plane. So if we see this world as, you know, Satan's realm, you know, what the Gnostics would call the Archons, and what Schreiner would call Araman, or however you want to, you know, that the worldly powers, disease, death, strife, war, all these, you know, these elements that we can call evil, satanic, and so on, that certainly seemed during Jesus' time to be paramount, to be, you know, ruling the entire reality of these people. What he was, his way of, I don't know if you want to say circumventing that, was to awaken godliness in the believer, and sort of create this almost like this filament or this network where people are, you know, like people are switching that light on. They're not succumbing, you know, to the satanic system, which again to me is, you know, the power of the Roman Empire and the worldly powers and so on, which, you know, they require submission, they require complicity, right? They require surrender. What he was saying is that there's a countervailing force here, and that's the power of the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God. And we can bring that kingdom to this plane, to this earth, to this world. We can bring the kingdom of God into Satan's kingdom. Okay. Now, he wasn't talking about like nature and creation as being Satan's kingdom. It was the cosmos. It was the world system, that Satan was the system. Okay. Satan was the embodiment and the avatar of the system, not, you know, not denying nature, not denying creation, not denying the dramas of life and death, but bringing the kingdom of God into the kingdom of heaven. Now, if you go back and reread the Gospels, I think that interpretation is pretty well attested to. Now, that's something that people just have a real hard time wrapping their heads around. You know, it just seems like and it certainly seemed at the time to, you know, as we see this, and, you know, and I've argued that the whole Jesus mythicist argument is just completely specious and just doesn't hold up, right?
Which argument?
The mythicist argument.
Oh, that it's a myth.
Yeah, that it's all myth. I mean, yeah. Certainly, you know, you could argue that there are mythical elements tacked on, which were done to, you know, every historical figure at the time was mythologized, right? So you can argue that there's a certain degree of mythologizing inherent, just it's the nature of the beast, right? No pun intended. But, you know, that's how I see this, you know, but it's very hard for people, because I think it's hard for people because it requires them to take responsibility. All right. That, you know, you have to be an active daily, hourly, minutely participant in this process. Right. You know, that is granted through grace. And then you think, well, what if the grace is ungranted? You know, what if the grace is withdrawn? So there are all these different variables that people are very uncomfortable with, and were obviously very uncomfortable with at the time, as we can see attested to in the Gospels themselves. People just have a hard time dealing with that because it is metaphysical. It is, I would argue, true mysticism. And people have a hard time dealing with that because, you know, we have to get through the day. We have to pay our bills. We have to, you know, get the kids to school. We have to, you know, buy the groceries and all these kind of things that people just have a real hard time squaring that type of mystical surrender to powers that they can't measure. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, so the counterfeit is you just believe in Jesus Christ and you'll be saved. And so then you have, as you say, there's a shirking of responsibility in which people are believing things they don't even understand based on things that institutions have told them to believe, and thereby becoming actually subject to a system that, well, is not of God. They're actually becoming, they're in service of the very opposite thing that they think that they're getting aligned with because of laziness, essentially.
Well, I see, but the only problem is I don't think we should overstate that. I think this is there's like sort of an absolutist way of interpreting that if, you know, if the church is not completely godly, completely pure, then it's completely satanic. And that to me, again, is a shirking of responsibility. You know, just throwing up your hands and saying, well, if things aren't perfect and if things don't follow this whole Platonic idea of perfected forms, then they're completely satanic. Sure. And that's to me is the error of the Gnostics. That's the essence of the error of Gnosticism, is subscribing to these, you know, these Platonic ideals that are just imaginary concepts.
Yeah, well, funny enough, I was kind of going to go there because it occurred to me as well that it's almost as though we've been given two false choices. One is this kind of servile submission to belief and institutional dogma, and the other is basically occultism, where we actually try and put our hands on these Christian symbols and principles and actually apply them in a way that we're standing up and you know, taking charge of our own beliefs and being more proactive, and that it so quickly becomes occultism. Like, it's hard to even distinguish that kind of proactive or autonomous Christianity, if you will, or autonomous worship from occultism. It's like there's this tiny margin that if we can stay in it, it's the eye of the needle, I guess, that camels can't go through, where we're surrendering without being passive.
Well, are you familiar with Prosperity Gospel? I don't know if they have that over in Europe.
No, I don't think so.
So Prosperity Gospel is very popular in America and the Americas.
Yeah.
And basically,
saying that you succeed if you're devout.
No, it's basically like, are you familiar? Do you remember The Secret, that New Age thing?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
so it's basically kind of the law of attraction where God becomes a genie.
Yeah, right.
And it's incredibly materialistic. I actually have a Christian friend who said it was from the deepest pits of hell. You know, it's just ultra Americanized. It's all about, you know, if you ask God, he'll give you whatever you want. You just have to follow a couple of rules. But even those rules aren't terribly strenuous to follow. It is occultic. It is, you know, like it's the law of attraction. Just with a very thin Christian veneer. What I would argue, and I guess this is maybe where faith comes in. Now, faith has been dumbed down to be this whole idea of you just believe in things you can't see or touch or taste or whatever. And that to me isn't what faith is. Faith is, like, say you and I are involved in some kind of enterprise, and you have shown over the course of months or years that you will do the job that, you know, is required when it needs to be done. And that is the faith that I have. I have faith in you that you will do that because you have shown me, you have proven to me that you can do that, right? That you will do that, right? And that's how I define faith. And maybe, you know, more, I don't know, traditional or conservative interpretations of Christianity would not. But that's me is what, you know, it's like I have faith in things that maybe I can't see on a material level, but I just have faith that they will happen because they've happened before. You know, that there's this pattern that's been established that to me is reliable.
Yeah.
Maybe that isn't faith. I don't know.
For me, that is. I mean, it's hard to distinguish it from trust, actually, but there is a subtle distinctions. And anyway, why do we need to distinguish it? Because they're very similar, and it's very much close to how I experience myself as having faith. And it is based on experience. It's not blind faith. It's faith with vision, because I have been through so many hard times, and I've so many times I've been, praying in the foxhole, so to speak. So many times I've felt like everything was going to shit. And some part of me has been saying, just hold on, and just hold on a bit longer, and it will sort itself out. Whereas another part of me is crying out to God. But I've come through so many times that even though I know I will lose my shit the next time things go to hell, each time there is more faith, because there's more of an experiential sense of what you just said, that there is a principle behind existence that is just, is fair. We're really getting into the Book of Job territory now, but it's not about what I personally want, and that's the faith, that actually I cannot get what I want, and even get the thing I least want, and later on down the line I will say, actually that was right that happened. That's happened enough to me that even when the bad things are happening in the present, a big part of me is saying, just wait, just you wait, you will, if not be grateful for this, you will certainly accept that it was right.
Well, I think there's also a sense, concurrent with what you're saying, is patience.
Yeah.
So patience, trust, and faith, I think, are very closely linked. But yeah. There's also, I think, and this, I'm gonna not be able to tell you like which chapter and verse this is sort of spelled out in, but an idea that you see in many religious traditions, particularly what they call the axial traditions, Christianity and Buddhism and so on, where I'm not the focus of the world. The sun doesn't shine and set on me personally. It's like I am part of this greater community, this greater project, this greater creation. And if I can control and moderate my desires and learn to let go of things that I think I want, maybe because society's conditioned me to want those things, I will be a much happier person. Mm-hmm. Right. Making do with less. That is almost in America, that's almost like heresy.
Yeah. Right?
What are you, a communist or something? It's like, no, it's about living simply, simplicity, clearing out the clutter in your life. Because that stuff becomes, this is a horrible cliche, but we become owned by our possessions, I've always gotten rid of things, and it's always like very cleansing and liberating to let go of these things, because I do start to feel like I'm owned by my possessions. So not needing what the prosperity gospel teachers tell you need, where just ask God and you'll get that 24-foot speedboat that you've been looking at, or you'll get that Hummer or that Ford truck that you want. I mean, all these just incredibly specious and superficial and just disgustingly materialistic impulses that drive that whole abomination, let's just call it. But, just live simply and don't think, that your shit doesn't stink. I mean, just realize that, you are here by the grace of God, and have, feel a tremendous amount of gratitude. I mean, I talk about this a lot, particularly on Twitter, I'll say having an attitude of gratitude it's to me, it's like a form of magic itself. It just completely changes the world. You think, well, I could die at any moment. I've seen a lot of people die, young people die in the past 10 years because of this hideous heroin and fentanyl thing that was, very much problematic here. To me, at my age, I'm a couple of years older than you, but, I've had a career. I've retired that from that career. I have three adult children. I have a house and a car. I have just I feel wealthy beyond imagining. I feel, just so utterly grateful. I mean, people will look at me and think, well, you know, you're kind of like lower middle class at best. And I think, what are you talking about? It's like, you know, my riches are not of this earth. You know, when Christ talks about don't put, you know, your stock in things that will go to moth and rust, you know, that I think that's, you know, a powerful message that transcends, you know, any denomination or religious, you know, that is just, to me, it's like a universal thing. And yeah. And I think there's so much in the gospel, particularly in Christ's teachings, that are, you know, don't require you to submit to some sort of identity to incorporate into your life.
Yeah. So you're in your second Saturn return now, Chris.
I guess I am. my first one was, well, I don't know. It's really hard to say. I my understanding of astrology is next to nil, but there right. was a point when like they said that Saturn was in my fourth house or something. That was when it was my first Saturn return was wonderful. That was one of the best times of my life. It was this other intermediary period that I don't understand because I don't understand astrology to save my life. But there you go.
Well, it's pretty basic. You know, Saturn's the paternal planet. And so he makes sure you've got your shit together. And if you haven't got your shit together, he'll get it together for you or he'll just snuff you out. Hence the 27 Club.
Yeah. I just want to say one more thing, though. I'm sorry for just being a total motor mouth here. But so my wife and I have kept a lot of animals over the years. You know, a lot of cats and dogs particularly, and we've formed, you know, bonds with these creatures closer really than we have with other people. And I've watched them die.
Yeah.
You know, more
what kind of animals is doing
that? Just, you know, dogs and cats mostly, but we also, you know, we've had birds and we just had two rabbits die. We have a hedgehog. So we've seen these creatures, you know, particularly dogs, because I'm a huge dog lover. My dog Linda, who really pulled me out of, it's hard to describe and take a whole show itself, but she pulled me out of hell. Mm-hmm. I really believe that. You know, she was like my psychopomp.
Right.
And she passed away early this year, and not a day goes by where I don't think of her and I don't miss her, right? But I guess that has, having these experiences where, you know, loving another creature so intensely and then watching them die has kind of, I don't want to say it's accustomed or acclimated me, but it's just gotten me to accept that death is just a part of the natural order. It's part of God's creation. And you can mourn because you miss these beings, these souls. But again, I very strongly believe in reincarnation. So, because I see it, you know, a tree falls and it rots and new trees sprout from it. To me, it's just part of God's order. And, you know, I guess that makes me a heretic, but what doesn't?
Yeah, sure. And how is your health, Chris?
It's small, you know, it's just a small suburban house.
Not your house, your health.
My health.
Yeah.
You know, it's better than it was.
Cause you had some condition. I remember back.
I still do, but the problem was that it was being improperly treated.
Okay.
For so, yeah. 10 years. So more, I'm sorry, 15 years. Yeah.
Because I don't know if you know, I had so-called CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, from my 20s to whatever, my 40s. I don't know. I would say I've left it behind now, pretty much.
I still struggle with chronic fatigue. So.
Right, and that's connected to whatever it is that you were diagnosed with.
Yeah, exactly.
Because didn't it include body pains as well?
Yeah, pretty bad. So it's an inflammatory condition. These doctors are all on the take from the pharmaceutical companies, especially around here. They refuse to treat it with anti-inflammatories for some inexplicable reason. and, you know, opioids and all the rest of that garbage, and all of which made my pain worse, not only because the root cause of the pain, which was inflammation, wasn't being addressed, but also because I was experiencing what's called a paradoxical effect where, you know, if you're on opioids for a certain period of time, they do the exact opposite of what they're supposed to do. Your brain sort of outsmarts them. But what also all those drugs did, and it wasn't just opioids, it's a number of other drugs, is that they, you know, screwed up my ability to produce endorphins and dopamine and norepinephrine, you know, all these chemicals that the brain creates to heal itself, really, or to heal, you know, to, I'm sorry. After a while, if I talk too much, I start to get very tongue-tied, but to relieve pain and so on, or to tolerate pain. So, I mean, doctors were mistreating me or maltreating me. I'm not exactly sure the terminology. They just weren't addressing the root cause of the problem because pharmaceutical companies were coming in and giving them thousands of dollars to prescribe their latest garbage, their latest poisons. And that's how I see most of that stuff now, is literal poison.
Yeah. Right. So since you got off that crap, you found other ways to deal with it, and it's just it's generally less oppressive now, I take it.
Well, see, I went through a period where I was taking a heavy course of anti-inflammatory drugs, and that really helped quiet down the symptoms quite a bit, because I mean it got intolerable. I mean I would have like literal days where I couldn't sleep, I couldn't watch television, I couldn't read, right. I couldn't focus on anything but just this intolerable pain that I would be in, more days than I can count, actually. And it was, you know, it was going through hell. I mean, it was torture. It was like being tortured all day. It was intolerable.
How long did that go on for?
Years.
Wow. So what, I mean, because I'm not just asking out of personal concern for your health, I'm asking in the context of our conversation and Job and my own experiences with years and years of, it doesn't sound anywhere near as bad as yours, but it was intolerable. I mean, I would be rolling around on the floor howling. It was just so, but it was much more of an insidious kind of metaphysical kind of pain. It wasn't particularly local. It was just like being trapped in this kind of satanic web. Anyway, you don't need to hear my story, just the point being that I also went through, you know, day after day, week after week, month after month, and year after year of a day not going by without wrestling with this existential agony. And I look at it very differently looking back on it, and even at the time I had a certain view of it that it was serving some sort of purpose. So I'm curious how it's been for you. Like, do you see any upside?
Well, I do quite a bit. I thank you for asking. you're familiar with the Catholic doctrine of purgatory, right?
Yes.
Right. So
I'm intimately familiar.
Yes. So, and you know about Meister Eckhart's description that The demons in hell are actually angels, and they're pulling away your attachments and so on.
Yeah, because it's in Jacob's Ladder, but yes.
I exactly. Know. Yes, a movie that I've watched over 100 times myself. Oh, wow. That's how I know it. But you know, I do feel that a lot of bad ideas and poor spiritual attitudes were kind of beaten out of me, to be honest with you. It really sort of, it's very hard to maintain a sense of narcissistic self-adoration when you're spending all day writhing in bed in just intolerable pain. it kind of pulls all that, but it's also those attachments and so on. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, both of us have moved past, a lot of kind of, you know, I know you've talked about Whitley and I always forget that Canadian fellow that you've gotten
John Baruta.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I don't want to overstate the case, but you know, I think that if you follow those paths, it can lead you to, you know, to very dark places, you know, and it can put your soul itself in jeopardy. So, you know, we've both of us, having been through all this stuff and seen a lot of these things come and go, a lot of ideas that people, to this day still put a lot of stock in, you know, we can sort of recognize as being very dangerous, you know, because it leads you to a point, like you talked about transhumanism. First of all, I mean, let me just say that transhumanism is just utter nonsense. It's just completely untenable. It will never work. All it will lead to is destruction and pain and misery for everyone who adheres to it. It's just never going to work. We cannot usurp creation. We cannot usurp the creator, right? It's just like because we don't have all the data that we need, right?
Right.
There's all sorts of data, and this is, you know, really a focus of a lot of the work that I'm doing now, is just sort of, you know, increasing, you know, the data flow, you know, because we just don't understand. I don't believe in, I don't know if you do, but I'm very much a disbeliever in Darwinian evolution, and not because I subscribe to a literalistic interpretation of Genesis, which I most definitely don't, but because I watched two secular Jewish mathematicians basically tear the whole thing apart on a mathematical basis, and saying that Darwinian evolution is just completely mathematically untenable, not the least of which is because Darwin did not understand DNA. He didn't understand the double helix and the amino acids. He had no concept of these things, you know? So how can you write this whole doctrine, which it's a religious doctrine, let's be very clear about it, about, you know, this evolution, which really comes from the occult, let's be clear about that as well, of things, you know, metamorphosizing into other things, if you don't have all the data at hand. And I don't believe that we still have the data at hand. So, again, like, my complete rejection of Darwinian evolution is not based in religion. It's based in math and reality. Things do not turn into other things. They just don't. You know? Things die out and other things arise, but there's absolutely no evidence that anything has turned into something else. There's just none.
Well, there's butterflies.
What's that?
There's butterflies.
Yeah, but the thing is that we call a caterpillar, we see them as two separate phenomena, but they're the same phenomena. They're just, you know, it's larvae. You know, caterpillar is larva. You know, it's basically a fetus, right?
Sure. I don't believe in Darwinism either, but that doesn't mean I disbelieve it. I just, I'm not sold on it. It's just like the moon landing. I'm just not sold.
No, I'm very, well, first of all, I don't believe in the moon landing either. I mean, I'm very much anti-Darwinism because I think it's based in a phenomenon that you'd probably be familiar with the vestiges of, which is, Anglo superiority, because the full title is, you know, includes like the favored races, because there's this whole idea, you know, there's British Israelism and so on, all these imperial ideas that, you know, the British were the natural rulers of the world and were ordained by God and so on. And I think I think you cannot separate those ideas, those imperialistic ideas of genetic supremacy, from Darwinism itself. And I'll also go so far to say, and I'll get into all kinds of trouble with this, I don't even think scientists really believe it anymore. I think it's just a way of winnowing out, the chaff. You know, it's, if somebody doesn't believe in Darwinism, you kick their ass out the door because they're not going along to get along, so to speak.
How did we get from our health to this? I'm just wondering.
It's genetics. It's you know, the human organism. I think it's all interrelated. But on a higher level, it is, again, it's not. I think that adopting these ideas of supremacy is a form of narcissism.
You were talking about having your bad ideas burned away. I think that's
exactly.
One. Yeah, well, I mean, the way that I understood my sickness during it and now after, I mean, I understand it better after, now that I'm through that particular phase of suffering. I'm definitely not out of purgatory, but it's gone to subtler levels of being, let's say, was that I simply wasn't in my body enough, and therefore I was mistreating my body, like mishandling a car. Not that I'm equating body with possession or with technology, but just that simple analogy that we have to dwell in our body and move with our body in the ways that are that facilitate awareness. And so keep it really simple, it's like my soul couldn't get into my body, and so other things were getting in instead. You could say demons, you could say toxins or whatever it was, and so my body was in hell. It was kind of, I would say, literally in hell in a certain sense, and certainly my mind was therefore in hell. But the process, this purgatorial process, meant that my mind, my awareness, had to be more and more focused on the body, because I couldn't think about anything else, like you were saying. You know, it's just impossible to ignore. And so that forced me to spend, well, literally years, like putting my attention on my body, which I never would have done through some, you know, this Vipassana meditation or anything like that, because I was busy trying to be a, you know, an Uber shaman in psychedelics, right? So in that sense, I think that I became more and more embodied through that process, which was purgatorial. It was the only way, you know, it was the only way I was ever really going to put my attention where it needed to go.
Well, see, this is part and parcel of a lot of critiques that I have of, say, just our common or mundane understanding of Christianity, where it's a very Gnostic idea of the soul being separate from the body and such, mm. where you should see, you know, that we are souls embodied. We're embodied souls, right? You know, and the body is the gift. It's a gift, right? Yeah. It's you know, we're given this little funhouse ride for, what is it, 70, right? Years. I think that might be in Job, right? Anyhow, you know, for me personally, I think a lot of my problems were is that instead of focusing on, you know, and it's very similar to what you're saying, you know, I wasn't focusing on the moment. I was focused on the past and on this imaginary future.
Yeah.
And the past because, you know, without going into it, I had an extraordinarily messed up childhood, extremely traumatic, and I kind of developed the sense that because I went through all this misery and abuse, that it entitled me, like somehow I was entitled to compensation for that. Right. Do you understand what I'm saying? And that to me, that was my sin, which is, you know, sin is error, right? That was my error in thinking that somehow I was entitled to compensation. And then I was looking to the future, that I was always seeing the, you know, since I wasn't receiving this compensation now, that it would always be in the future. So I wasn't focused on being embodied, being in the moment, being in creation. I was always stuck inside my head, you know, just sort of always, you know, commiserating about these failures. Are these traumas
and success.
Failures as well, and looking, you know, constantly looking to this future reward, because I didn't realize that the reward was in the now, that I had it, you know what I mean? that it had always been granted to me, you know what I mean? And I think the pain sort of, it was like shaking me out of that, you know, shaking me out of this whole idea that, okay, so I had this level of trauma that was inflicted upon me by other people. I forgave them. I forgave most of these people for doing that. And I didn't, like, you know, the skies didn't open and gold coins didn't fall from the sky. And, you know, people didn't throw roses at my feet, you know, that somehow I was entitled to this, because I didn't realize that, you know, through this grace process, that I already had everything that I actually wanted and that I actually needed, more importantly. So I think that was my purgatory, was shaking me out of this whole notion that I was somehow entitled to compensation for the things that I had to go through.
Yeah, so there's a lot of parallels with the Book of Job here, because, like, Job, obviously, needless to say, he really suffers. There's more than one book, by the way, so it gets confusing if you talk about it as one book, because they mix different things together. But anyway, there's a period of his, bad things happen and he doesn't curse God. But then there's this whole period where his friends come to console him, and he gets more and more irascible, right? He's just rejecting more and more of their consolation. And it's ironic, actually, because what you're saying there about how you felt that you should be recompensed for your suffering, that's what that's the kind of doctrine that the friends are trying to push on him in reverse. And they're saying you're only suffering because you sinned, right? Which there is the truth in this, that you and I reach this sense that we were somehow in error in our way of living and our way of thinking, and that the suffering was setting us right. But this isn't what Job's friends are telling him. They're telling him that you're being punished because you sinned, which really the flip side of it's retribution. It's a theology of retribution. It's the flip side of if I'm devout and virtuous, then God will reward me. Right. So Job is actually pushing against that. And Job is basically getting more and more expressive as his suffering. He's complaining more and more. And he's basically saying, this God that you're talking about is not a just God, because I don't deserve this suffering. Right? I didn't do anything. And the way that the book is arranged, we as the reader know that's true, because he was singled out by God, who was bragging to Satan, look at Job, he's so great, right? And Satan says, oh yeah, let me get to work on it. We'll see how loyal he becomes. And God says, yeah, all right, why not? Right? So it's this weird setup in which we know that Job essentially is innocent, at least of, like, he's not being punished anyway, he's being tested. And then anyway, by the end, basically all Job is demanding, well, he's demanding a number of things, but his main thing is he just wants God to show up and explain it to him, right? Why am I in such agony? What did I do? And finally God does show up, and God basically says, who the hell are you to ask, right? I've got bigger fish to fry, don't you know that, Job? I'm running the whole universe, and you're you're making me come down and, like, explain it to you. But at the same time, he does come down and he talks to him. So it's as though it's communicating a number of things, but relevant to what we're talking about. But one being that it's okay, it's more than okay for Job to lament and complain and cry out to God, because that's just part of being human. He just doesn't understand the agony of his situation. And actually, he does get through to God. It's just that he doesn't get what he wants from God, because what he thinks he wants isn't what he needs, right? And it's not, God doesn't have time to explain it to him. And Job wouldn't understand, I mean, not that there is a God in this personal sense, obviously, but existence itself is taking care of everything, right? And so, but as long as our focus, as Job's focus is on himself and he's saying, why me? He's going to suffer unnecessarily. So it takes God, it takes that part of him to come to awareness, which is, wait a minute, as you just said, for you, it isn't just me, right? This all of this suffering, it's not the most important thing in the world, right? And it's even for you or I personally, it's not the only thing that's happening, right? We're in physical pain and our dreams are not coming true, right? Our future isn't working out and our past was hell. And, you know, what, all these thoughts that we can have, they're ignoring the fact that we're alive and that all these other things are happening. We're still part of creation. So that is essentially part of the message of the Book of Job, I would say. And it's really simple and succinct in that way. And it's a dead match for what you've just expressed.
Well, I would offer something even further that I think a lot of people don't understand. So in the Christian Bible, Job is sort of put in the middle, in the middle of the Old Testament.
Yeah.
It's my understanding that Job was at the end of the Hebrew Bible.
The Tanakh. Yeah.
Okay. So what comes after, and I think that this was a mistake on the part of the church. Because what comes after Job is Christ, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And what is Christ's answer to Job is compassion.
Yeah.
that instead of his friends coming to him and telling him, oh, you know, you're a terrible person, you did this, and this is why you suffer, and so on, to share, you know, to alleviate, to share his burdens, right? Compassion, which is shared suffering, right? Yeah. And this is why I'm always talking about entomology, because, you know, we lose track of what things really mean because our language has been so degraded. So I think that that was a mistake on the part of the church, because in the Christian tradition, Christ is the answer to Job, isn't it? Because Christ suffers at the cross, right?
Yeah, exactly. Job is a forerunner of Christ. The book of Job is describing the early or the first attempt, really, for God to incarnate. Job is getting to experience what it's like to be God.
Well, and see, that's why it makes more sense in that context. And this is why I'm saying, like, you don't need to go to, like, I don't know, the Book of Oaspi or the Gnostic Gospels or the Aquarian Gospel of Christ, whatever. You just need to understand the context in which, you know, particularly the Gospels were written, but also what words meant, right? We just don't understand what words mean anymore. And sometimes the meanings themselves, through translation and just through the forces of history, you know, those meanings have been lost, right? They've just been sort of washed away. And it's the same thing that sort of, you know, we see with ancient astronaut theory, right? Or it's like, oh, this must have been the aliens because we don't understand these things. You know, we don't understand how these things were made. Well, back then they did. You know, they weren't all, you know, there's this whole idea that everybody before us, you know, before us marvelous 20th century, 21st century technocratic marvels, you know, who can basically barely do anything anymore, are somehow superior to people who could do trigonometry or calculus without computers, you know, without calculators, right? Somehow, and, you know, with little stone tablets, right? Somehow we're superior to these people. It's just the opposite of truth. So I don't have an answer to it. Again, I mean, it's way above my pay grade, and maybe it's just too late. Maybe we just need to let the clock run out. You know what I mean? You know, maybe the accelerationists are right. You know, we shouldn't delay this process of the collapse of the beast system. We should accelerate it. We should push it forward. That to me becomes problematic in itself, because that's where like the Sabbatean heresy arises in the Middle Ages, right? We've got to sort of like become so wicked that God is forced, we'll force God's hand. And that to me is like, that's almost where accelerationism inevitably leads. Yeah. But maybe not collectively, but I think personally, on an individual level, you know, if we're interested in these things, and if we're interested in maybe reading up on, like, people solving these problems that we have today, you know, that nothing is new, you know, we've been through all this before, and maybe people who are a lot smarter than us, like people who could do calculus without calculators, figured it out somehow, maybe we can as well. But what we need to understand is we need to understand context. Context, context, context. And without context, that's when you have, you know, prosperity gospel and all the rest of the horror show that passes for Christianity these days.
Yeah, chaos.
Chaos, social chaos. And the sick Calvinism without grace that is called woke.
Well, I'm a firm believer, if that's the word. This probably isn't the word, because I don't want to be a believer at all, but I'm an advocate of the microcosm, just as we're talking about Job being a forerunner of Christ and Christ being God in microcosm, which is available to all of us. I mean, theoretically, as far as we're human at all, that in an individual life, yours or mine, because we're the only ones here right now until this goes public, it's possible to experience that full spectrum of movement from confusion, misunderstanding, ignorance, sin, evil, whatever, you know, all the different words for it, to understanding, to surrender, to grace, to to revelation and to truth. And okay, you know, I'm running out of time now, but still, I've definitely lived a life that's full of sin without doing too much real harm to others, thank God. Did give too many psychedelics to young people, but that's probably the worst of it. And now in my 50s, I'm living not off the land, but at least on the land, and raising animals. And, you know, I mean, I'm on my way. I'm on my way. And to me, that's the way. I mean, the acceleration of the apocalypse. They've all got plenty of social engineers just working day and night on nothing else, right? They don't need more. Right? So my focus is actually on helping to create and sustain the alternative, which is the old way, as you put it. I mean, it's ancient way of man and of woman, and it's not rocket science, thank God, right? We're not going anywhere. We're just trying to get rooted here and now. So I'm reasonably content with that, you know, with my lot currently, despite the fact that I still have a legion of demons to let go of or to transform. At least I've pretty much made it geographically where I need to be, and my orientation is away from the system, that the beast, and towards nature, you know, the natural physical realm.
Well, see, that's the thing, is that you can't. I don't think you can have like a true metaphysics or a true spirituality without creation, right? Yeah. So for a number of various historical reasons, we had this sort of anti-natural, anti-nature, anti-creation ideology or attitude migrate from Gnosticism into Christianity, right? And it probably happened in that period, like that 6th century, quote-unquote, Dark Ages period. I'm not sure. And it maybe sort of popped up again with the rise of Calvinism and Protestant Reformation and so on. You know, it became very, very Gnostic in its denial of nature and creation. Yeah. And you sort of have to, it's a tough thing, you know, because there's this automatic impulse, on not only Christians, but, you know, other religious traditions, that if you sort of acknowledge the primacy of nature, then you become a pagan, or at least an animist, right?
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, unfortunately, you know, the book of Genesis kind of refutes that argument, you know, what I'm saying?
Fruitful and multiply.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's, I don't know, it's beyond me. And, no one asks, well, you're asking me, but, you know, people usually don't ask me, so I don't feel any responsibility to volunteer my services, because, like I said, I mean, I think things are just racing to this finale now, and there's no stopping it. And like I said, we've been here before, we'll be here again. It's all cyclical, and, you know, for lack of a better term, it's all part of God's plan.
Yeah. Well, so isn't it back to this thing of, you know, where our attention is and therefore where our orientation is? Because we can't, it's like Leonard Cohen saying, you know, there's no decent place to stand in a massacre. We can't actually avoid the apocalypse, but nor would we want to. We are part of the human experience, but we don't have to get carried along by the herd. Right?
Well, exactly. We don't have to participate in the atrocity.
Yeah. Exactly. So we'd be witnesses to it, and that in itself has a purpose for us and for creation, I think.
But like I said, the book of Revelation has got the happiest ending of any book ever, you know, if you subscribe to that way of thinking, right?
Yeah. It's making me think of Bhagavad Gita, you know. I was going to say, the trick is, as long as you can let go of family members who might end up in the lake of fire, right? Because there is a division in the book of Revelation. It's not like everybody gets a ticket out, apparently.
Well, and, you know, good people suffer, you know. I mean, it is that. Did Jung write Answer to Job?
Yes, I was going to ask you if you'd read that, because I know you're into Jung, or where it used to be.
Yeah, I used to be pretty, and actually I'm starting to sort of pick up some of that again. I had to step away from Jung, because I first of all, he was a weird dude and had a lot of weird
yeah,
ideas.
Gnostic, yeah.
And also because I just got so tired of people just dropping Jungian buzzwords when they wanted to sound like they were saying something profound and were actually saying something, you know, trivial and specious. Yeah, it's the same thing with, I know I've gotten into some trouble with this when I talk about Robin Anton Wilson, because people always quote Robin Anton Wilson when they want you to just, you know, return to their comfort zones, you know, because that's really what it's all about. I mean, Robin Anton Wilson's just, you know, it's comfort food for people who sort of want to play in Chapel Perilous, but close to the door. But it's the same thing with Jung. You know, I always blame it. To me, it's like almost more like Campbell or Hillman, you know, these people who sort of interpreted Jung and popularized Jung. But like I said, I mean, Jung was really into like Mithraism and stuff, which to me is just.
I know. But don't you find, I mean, what I'm finding at this tail end of my mapping hell is that now that I've really identified so many of these toxic influences, I feel I can, it's like I got a prophylactic, not that I believe in rubber johnnies, but in a real sense, but psychically, like I could sort of, it's not like I forgive Jung, but I just say, well, okay, now I can take the good and leave the bad. Now that I've actually recognized the bad influences, I can see that there is still good in there. I'm finding that with almost everything.
That's beautiful. I'm glad you said that. That is a beautiful thing. You know, take what you can use and discard the rest. Purity, ideological purity, to me, leads back to hell. I mean, I think that ideological purity or even theological purity is one of the, you know, it's one of the expressways to hell. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's the wrong orientation. It's like you're saying about the body, that the soul actually wants to be close to the body. So if we're identifying with the soul or we're aligned with the soul, then we're in love with nature and the physicality and the rest of it. If we're rejecting physicality, we're not identifying with the soul. So we've turned everything upside down, or had it turned upside down for us, and don't even realize. You know,
but I just want to add something to that, because, you know, we talked about the whole Gnostic idea and then some of the ideas that came in through Calvinism or Jansenism or whatever, where it became very disembodied. But that to me is like, are you questioning God's wisdom to place you within a body?
Yeah. Right.
You know, is that somehow an error?
Yeah.
You know, and that's where we get into this whole idea, these Gnostic ideas of, I mean, these bizarre cosmologies where everything descends in these layers from purity to physicality. And that to me, it doesn't go anywhere. You know, it just leads you into just completely solipsistic navel gazing. And what point is that?
Yeah. Well, I suggest that we quit while we're ahead.
Hey, why not, right? Why not?
Yeah.
I enjoyed this, though. This was great. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad we covered a lot, but we got to something just experiential, so that's always important, I think.
Well, you know, it always seems like, I mean, not completely parallel tracks, but we've sort of been on roughly parallel tracks, and, you know, we can sort of look where we are and look back at where we were and really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're probably the only guy I'm still in touch with, actually, from the stormy weather days. I mean, in terms of other researchers and whatnot, pretty much.
Well, I don't know where a lot of them went. A lot of them just, like, vanished. They're back into the woodwork, you know? I don't know what's going on in that whole, you know, field, so to speak. I mean, it was always very loose and fluid.
But it takes real stamina. It's ironic that you and I have lasted the distance, and yet we're the ones with chronic fatigue, isn't it?
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, maybe that's grace in and of itself, you know?
I think so, yeah. Grace under fire is the only real grace.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. I'm gonna have to think about that.
Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers. Someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers. Someone who's there. Feeling unknown and you're all alone, flesh and bone, by the telephone. Lift up the receiver, I'll make you a believer. Take second best, put me to the test. Things on your chest, you need to confess. I will deliver, you know I'm a forgiver. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith. Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers. Someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus. Someone to hear your prayers. Someone to care. Feeling unknown and you're all alone, flesh and bone, by the telephone. Lift up the receiver, I'll make you a believer. I will deliver, you know I'm a forgiver. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith. Reach out and touch faith.